Headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei warns of U.S. attempts to interfere in the JCPOA as well as Iran's missile program and regional issues in the future. A Taliban delegation visits China to discuss security and the peace process with Chinese officials. And Armenia says three soldiers have been killed and two others wounded in fresh border clashes between Azeri and Armenian troops. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the West is untrustworthy and deals blows whenever it gets the chance. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said domestic programs should not be tied to the West. Cooperation as a dependence on the West will result in failure. He said Iran was successful whenever it did something without reliance on the West. The leader underscored that Iran failed to make progress whenever it linked issues to agreements and talks with the West, including the U.S. Ayatollah Khamenei underlined the West will not help, as it's an enemy. He also criticized Washington for failing to keep its promise of lifting anti-Tehran sanctions. The leader said the U.S. is seeking a pretext to interfere in the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and missile activities, as well as regional issues. Ayatollah Khamenei made the comments when he received outgoing Iranian President Hassan Rouhani and his cabinet ministers. President-elect Ebrahim Raisi is to be sworn in on the 5th of August. Political analyst Fouad Izzadi says Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei's speech is a signal to the U.S. that the country will not forget the lessons of the past 8 years.
I don't think we had anything new sentences that had to pay with truth any three times in the past. Trusting the West, not relying on the West for resolving the country's economic problems, and making sure that the West, especially the United States, does not take advantage of these negotiations to advance its foreign policy goals towards Iran, are themes that have been used in different speeches in the last 7 or 8 years. And I think the reason Ayatollah Khamenei repeated these sentences was to basically put this for historical records, that what happened in the last 8 years, and the aim is basically to provide a historical background for the new administration that's going to start in Iran in just a few days. So overall, I think what we are going to see is the lessons of the last 8 years is going to be something that's going to be highlighted both by Ayatollah Khamenei and the new Iranian government as they go forward with these talks. And this is a signal to the United States as well that Iran is not going to forget the lessons of the last 8 years.
Israeli forces have violently clashed with Palestinian protesters in the occupied West Bank town of Beita, injuring over 100 of them. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent, Israeli troops opened live fire and used tear gas on people protesting against the killing of a 41-year-old Palestinian man a day before. Witnesses said Shadi Omar Lotfi Salem was returning home from work when he was gunned down near the entrance of Beita. There were no protests when he was killed by the regime soldiers. Tel Aviv claims the slain man had approached soldiers in a, quote, menacing manner. Rights groups have for long condemned Israel for using excessive and brute force against Palestinians. Lebanon's new prime minister, designate Najib Mirati, has begun consultations with leading political parties with a view to forming a long-awaited government. The politician, already twice a prime minister, was designated on Monday, days after Saad Hariri failed to form a cabinet and stepped down.
Lebanese Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati said he hoped he can regain the trust of the people in the role of the state. He also vowed to meet with President Michel Aoun regularly in order to speed up the formation of the new government.
There was full unanimity on demand and swiftness in the formation of the new government. And after today's session, I briefed President Owen on the outcome, and I always visit the presidential palace in order to achieve the government's formation as soon as possible.
Mikati spoke after a day of non-binding meetings with Lebanese lawmakers who stated their views after separate consultations. Free Patriotic Movement declared it will not be taking part in the next government, but will offer all the necessary facilitations and support for a quick formation.
We're starting from scratch. We're starting something new, no baggage. No one is carrying any historical disagreements between the parties. That's what we heard from the designated prime minister, and we hope that that will be reflected in the coming future, within hours or days at least, that this will make a difference.
Prime Minister Designate stressed that he has the foreign support necessary to begin economic reforms. One member of parliament told Press TV that when they asked about this support, Mikati stressed that France has given him assurances that after the formation of the cabinet, they will give all assistance to resolve the financial and economic crisis. However, this assistance will not be without interest.
No foreign country would give assistance for free. It has its own interest in mind as well. It's only natural when France gives aid to Lebanon, it has ambitions. If France assists in rebuilding the port, it could be the main future authority in the port of Beirut and could be managing the trade and commerce from Europe to the entire Arab world. If it rebuilds the electricity sector, it will also be a good investment for French companies. And at the same time, Lebanon is in drastic need of that assistance.
The main concern for all sides is salvaging the country's economy, which has been described by the World Bank as one of the world's worst since the 1850s. After initial meetings with lawmakers, the real political bargaining begins for the formation of the government. This in itself could prove to be controversial, with Mikati stressing the need for keeping to the French initiative, opponents stressing the need for adhering to the National Charter of Confessional Representation. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
A Taliban delegation visiting China has assured Beijing that the group will not allow Afghanistan to be used as a base for plotting against another country. A Taliban spokesman said the delegation made it clear to Chinese officials that those concerns were unfounded. The remarks were in reference to a meeting between the Taliban delegation and Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi in the northern city of Tianjin. The spokesman said the two sides discussed the ongoing peace process in Afghanistan as well as political, economic, and security issues. He said China also promised not to interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and rather help to solve problems and bring peace. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said Beijing has told the Taliban delegation that the U.S. Hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan shows a failure of Washington's policies toward the country.
Afghanistan belongs to the Afghan people, and the future and destiny of Afghanistan should be in the hands of the Afghan people. The hasty withdrawal of the United States and NATO troops from Afghanistan actually marks the failure of the United States' policy towards Afghanistan. And the Afghan people have an important opportunity to stabilize and develop their own country.
The spokesman quoted Wang Yi as saying that the Taliban is a pivotal military and political force, are expected to play an important role in ending Afghanistan's war and rebuilding the country. The visit comes as the group continues a sweeping offensive across Afghanistan, including areas along Chinese borders. Various rounds of peace talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban have not made substantial progress. New clashes have erupted between Azeri and Armenian troops along their shared borders. Armenia's defense ministry says three soldiers were killed and two others were wounded. In another exchange of fire last week, an Azeri soldier was killed and three Armenian troops were wounded. Earlier this month, a cross-border shooting also left two people injured. These are the latest incidents between the two neighbors since their last year war over the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Over 6,500 people were killed in the conflict that ended in November 2020 with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. French President Emmanuel Macron says his country owes a debt to French Polynesia for decades of nuclear testing in the South Pacific territory.
Je veux ici vous dire que la nation...
I want to tell you here that the nation owes a debt to French Polynesia This debt is because we essentially welcomed these nuclear tests between 1966 and 1974, and we can say with certainty that they weren't clean.
Macron made the remarks in a speech to Polynesian officials during his four-day visit to the region. He said he wants transparency on the issue and takes the responsibility for it. However, he stopped short of apologizing. Despite the calls by nuclear testing victims and activists, France had carried out nuclear explosions on the island from 1966 to 1996 as part of its atomic weapons developing program. A French investigative website said in March that more than 100,000 people may have been contaminated due to radiation exposure in Polynesia. Paris correspondent Chris Denhon says France is not showing accountability to compensate for its nuclear tests in French Polynesia.
Almost 200 nuclear tests took place between 1966 and 1996, and before 1975, these tests took place in the open air. So the facts are really dramatic. A law has been voted in 2010 to open a procedure for victims of the nuclear testing to get compensation. Macron promised to simplify this procedure and to give compensation to the victims. Now, before you receive compensation, you have to prove that you are a victim of these nuclear testing. Even simplified, it's not easy to prove that you are a victim of the nuclear testing of France in Polynesia.
Two American police officers have been arrested following the beating of an unarmed African-American man in the state of Colorado. The following footage from the officer's body cam contains graphic content and may be upsetting to some people.
Get on your face now, okay, bro? Get on your face, okay, bro? Okay,
get on your face.
On your face.
Me, bro.
On your face.
In the footage released by the Aurora Police Department, the victim repeatedly cries, "Don't shoot me," and "help." A male officer is seen pistol whipping and choking the man. The officer is charged with attempted first-degree assault, second-degree assault, oppression, felony menacing, and first-degree official misconduct. Also, a second officer is accused of failing to intervene and report the use of force by his colleague. Aurora police officials have called the arrest a very despicable act. Cities across the United States have been the scene of protests over police brutality and racial profiling against African Americans in recent years. Canadian police have revealed that they've been investigating abuse allegations at a former residential school for Indigenous children since 2011. The revelation follows an inquiry by a local media outlet in Manitoba province about the government-funded Fort Alexander School. Police say they've talked to more than 700 people in their search for potential victims. So far, no criminal charges have been filed. Fort Alexander was closed in 1970. It was one of dozens of boarding schools founded to forcibly integrate thousands of Indigenous children over the past century. Many children suffered ill treatment and systematic abuse at the church-run institutions at issue. The issue has drawn fresh attention in recent months after the discovery of more than 1,300 unmarked graves in several residential schools. International lawyer Barry Grossman says Canada's federal government needs to take serious action over the claims of abuse of Indigenous children.
It strikes me that they haven't dedicated the resources or the sense of urgency to this investigation that it calls for. It's getting out of hand. More and more burial sites are being discovered, unmarked graves are being discovered, and people want answers. And the Prime Minister certainly said he was committed to implementing the recommendations of a previous inquiry, but certainly a number of those recommendations and the people that needed to be funded are now saying that they're not in funds. They haven't received anything near the support that's required from the Canadian federal government. The people of Canada, the victims, the families of victims and their tribal relations all want answers. And to be sure, I mean, there's issues of money involved in all this, with the federal government obviously wanting to avoid unnecessary and inappropriate payouts. But ultimately, everything hangs on proper investigations. And from what I can see, the federal government has been paying lip service to this matter for far too long, and it's time for some action.
The Japanese capital has registered a record number of daily COVID-19 infections amid the ongoing 2020 Summer Olympic Games there. Tokyo reported over 3,000 cases for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic. Nearly 2,900 people were also tested positive a day before, despite the capital and its surrounding areas remaining under a fourth state of emergency. The spike in cases is likely to increase the scrutiny of the Olympic Games amid concerns that the event could drive infections. Elsewhere in Asia, South Korea has reported nearly 2,000 new COVID cases, its highest ever daily tally. Meanwhile, a two-week-long strict social distancing measure took effect across the country. On Tuesday, South Korea has so far recorded nearly 200,000 coronavirus infections and over 2,000 related deaths. The Australian city of Sydney extends its COVID-19 lockdown for another month due to a still-growing coronavirus outbreak and low vaccination rates. Authorities warn of tougher policing measures to control non-compliance. They've asked Sydney residents to report citizens breaking the rules. Sydney has been under lockdown for 5 weeks. So far, only 13% of Australians have received COVID vaccines. On Saturday, anti-lockdown protesters gathered in the cities of Sydney and Melbourne. Several people were arrested after violent clashes with police. Around half of Australia's 25 million people are now in lockdown in several cities. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate, June 4, 2021. The televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Formulating and implementing the theory of the Islamic Republic was Imam's great achievement. Our magnanimous Imam's great accomplishment was that he created this thought and this theory, the theory of the Islamic Republic, and brought it to the arena where various political theories existed. At that time, different political theories in the East and the West clashed with one another over political matters and outlooks. And he subsequently implemented and realized that theory. He did not just formulate theory, he executed it as well. And this way, he brought the Islamic Republic into existence. That was Imam's great achievement. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, Imam's deep understanding of Islam and deep trust in the people helped him formulate and execute the theory of the Islamic Republic. Well, Imam, may God the Exalted bestow paradise on him, was a great man in many different ways, one of which was his religious knowledge and understanding, the source of support for creating that theory and then putting it into practice. Was on the one hand his deep understanding of Islam. He knew Islam and he knew that Islamic governance was the main message of Islam. On the other hand was his deep faith in the people. He had tremendous faith in the people. He believed in their capabilities, willpower and loyalty. And we have an abundance of memories about his astonishing faith in them. In the solar year 1341, when the movement had just started, in one class he steered the discussion towards political matters and the most important affair of the country. He pointed to the desert in Qom, saying that if we at that time asked the people, they would have filled the desert. In the solar calendar 1341, no one would have thought that it would be possible to make the people join the cause. Imam would think that the two parts of the theory of the Islamic Republic, both its Islamic and Republic aspect, originated from Islam. His theory was based on Islam. Actually, it was his mastery over Islamic teachings and his deep and comprehensive understanding of Islamic lessons that crafted the theory in the mind of that great personality.
Tens of thousands of people in France, the UK, Italy, and Greece protested against coronavirus restrictions and mandatory vaccination policies, sparking clashes with police forces. The European governments tried to force more unvaccinated people to receive their coronavirus shots by using sanctions. In France, nearly 160,000 people held nationwide protests against the implementation of a health pass by President Emmanuel Macron's government. Demonstrators slammed this policy by saying it's an attack on their liberty. Macron's health pass will ban access to restaurants and public spaces for unvaccinated people. During the rallies, tensions flared up as French anti-riot police fired tear gas toward protesters and used water cannons to disperse them. Several demonstrators have also been arrested. Elsewhere in Europe, thousands of Italians took to the streets of Rome, Naples, and Turin against the government's introduction of restrictions on unvaccinated people. Protesters chanted slogans such as "Freedom" and "Down with the dictatorship" over plans for a government certificate known as the Green Pass. The Green Pass is an extension of the EU's digital COVID certificate and will be required from August 6th to enter cinemas, museums, indoor swimming pools, or sports stadiums, or eat indoors at restaurants. thousands of people have also protested in London against what they describe as an erosion of their civil liberties. Demonstrators denounced the UK government's track and trace app, saying it limits their movements. Over 600,000 people are told to self-isolate in 1 week alone this month. The protests come a week after most coronavirus restrictions in England were lifted. Police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse more than 4,000 people who had gathered in central Athens to protest against mandatory COVID-19 vaccinations. Police sources claim that some protesters had thrown petrol bombs, prompting the police to respond with tear gas.
Certainly the lockdowns are making people unhappy. They're driving up unemployment. They're adding to general restlessness. But the problem is broader. I mean, I think people are upset about the poor economy, which is and slow economic growth, which is now in its 13th or 14th year.
Tens of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets and called for the impeachment of President Bolsonaro, who is facing increasing pressure as the pandemic exacts a devastating toll. The South American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States, with over 500,000 deaths. Demonstrators and police scuffled in Sao Paulo, with the smoke rising from tear gas canisters and flashbangs exploding. Bolsonaro has seen his popularity declining amid a Senate probe into corruption scandals tied to the purchase of COVID-19 vaccines. His approval rating is at a low record of 24%. Bolsonaro has been famously dismissive of the health crisis, the need to wear face masks, and lockdown measures to halt the spread of the virus. In Australia, protesters carried signs and banners reading, "Wake up Australia," and "Drain the Swamp." Demonstrators defied a month-long stay-at-home order by participating in the unauthorized march in Sydney. Nearly 60 attendees were arrested. Demonstrators clashed with police officers and threw projectiles at them. Authorities suggested that the COVID-related restrictions could remain in place until October.
People have lost faith in the political classes. They don't believe that the politicians in charge know what they're doing, and they are quite angry and upset.
In many countries, anti-lockdown anger has merged with other grievances. Demonstrators criticize governments for suspending their right to protest because of the public health crisis. In addition, economic hardship and anxiety have further fueled public anger. According to a multi-agency United Nations report published last week, world hunger and malnutrition levels worsened dramatically last year, with most of the increase likely due to the coronavirus pandemic. The report said nearly 768 million people across the globe were undernourished in 2020, as the COVID-19 pandemic disrupted economies, job markets, and supply chains, as well as inflated food prices. The increase last year was equal to that of the previous 5 years combined. According to the report published by UN agencies including the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Food Program, and the World Health Organization, Asia accounts for over half of all undernourished people globally, while Africa experienced the biggest spike. The report says more than 149 million children under 5 are estimated to be afflicted with stunted growth. That means their brains and bodies do not grow to their full potential. Also, children who suffer from chronic hunger are more likely to die before reaching maturity. However, food insecurity was already spreading across the globe before the pandemic due to the conflicts, economic recessions, and climate change. That's why nearly all low- and mid-income countries have experienced economic downturns in 2020. Low-income countries are more vulnerable to food price shocks in particular. While a surge in consumer food price inflation predates the pandemic, early lockdown measures and supply chain disruptions induced a spike in the prices. Also, higher transport costs increased consumer food inflation. Some experts believe that food scarcity will probably trigger social unrest and bring people out into the streets, which is likely to make the next few months unstable.
Well, I think that we have to understand that the food problem is not simply a result of the COVID problem, but it's also a profound problem as a result of climate change.
...2020 posed a serious blow to food security around the world, and the effects of the pandemic are expected to linger. In 2030, an estimated 30 million more people may face hunger than would have without the COVID-19 outbreak. Many factors affect food security around the world. Therefore, a food system approach is required to find effective solutions. A report by the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World has recommended a number of actions to help prevent undernourishment. Those include increasing resiliency to conflict, climate change, and economic shocks, and sustainably ensuring access to affordable, nutritious food.
What we have to understand and what we should, as a society, be doing is encouraging increasing local trading systems and farmer-supported, community-supported farming organizations, such as those that exist around the world. It's called community-supporting agriculture, and they're very, very important because they provide a counterbalance to the increasing control and the lack of diversity that the large corporations are offering.
Food insecurity has been on the rise since the mid-2010s, especially in countries affected by conflict, climate extremes, economic downturns, or battling high inequality. The pandemic only exacerbated these existing challenges with significant negative effects, particularly for poor nations. Therefore, things are not going to change for better unless nations across the globe start working together.
On Friday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with visiting Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein at the State Department. The meeting comes ahead of discussions on the role of U.S. military forces in Iraq. U.S. media have cited American officials as saying that the two countries are expected to formalize the end of Washington's combat mission in Iraq by the end of the year. That shift is reportedly planned to be announced on Monday when U.S. President Joe Biden hosts Iraqi Prime Minister at the White House. It could potentially mark a new chapter in the ties between the U.S. and Iraq, 18 years after Washington deployed its troops in the West Asian country. In an interview, the Iraqi foreign minister said the presence of American combat units in Iraq is unnecessary at this stage. He said what Iraq needs is cooperation in intelligence and training, as well as Air Force support. Earlier this week, Iraqi Prime Minister also stressed that American combat troops should leave his country.
I believe that the U.S. will not fully disengage from Iraq. My guess is they will leave some troops there in at least an advisory capacity, and also that they will augment the official military with private contractors. I don't expect the U.S. to totally leave Iraq.
In the meantime, resistance movements in Iraq say the presence of the U.S. forces in the Arab country will only benefit Israel. Anti-U.S. sentiments in Iraq have been running high since January 2020, when Washington assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad airport. Following the assassination, the Iraqi parliament adopted a resolution that called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. Iraqi resistance groups have pledged to take up arms against U.S. forces if Washington fails to comply with the parliamentary order. While the U.S. justifies its presence in Iraq with fight against Daesh, Iraqis are stressing that they don't need foreign troops and that they're capable of dealing with the issue themselves.
The U.S., at least at times, has assisted groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, and I expect the U.S. to continue to do that. The reason the U.S. will stay in Iraq is to be able to have a base of operations from which to attack Iran and Syria and other countries and entities in the Middle East that the U.S. deems to be enemies.
On the other hand, the fact that apart from Daesh terrorists, the U.S. is the only perpetrator of attacks on Iraq's anti-terror popular mobilization units, which are legally incorporated as part of the Iraqi military, puts the U.S. claim of fighting terrorists in perspective.
Britain has announced the permanent deployment of two warships in the South China Sea amid growing tensions between the U.S. and China. Britain's Defense Secretary Ben Wallace said the U.K. will permanently assign two ships in the region by the end of this year. He made the announcement in a joint press conference with his Japanese counterpart in Tokyo on Tuesday.
Following on from the strike group's inaugural deployment, the United Kingdom will permanently assign two ships in the region from later this year, as well as contributing a littoral response group in the coming years to come.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and it hosts the biggest concentration of U.S. military forces outside of the U.S., including ships, aircraft, and troops. The deployment would be after a strike group consisting of U.K.'s Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier and escort ship sailed through the waters in the South China Sea in September. The Queen Elizabeth is being escorted by two destroyers, two frigates, two support vessels, and ships from the U.S. and the Netherlands. It will come to Japan through the South China Sea, parts of which are claimed by China and Southeast Asian countries, with stops in India, Singapore, and South Korea. In a statement on the deployment, Pentagon spokesperson congratulated Britain for its, quote, commitment to an interconnected network of allies and partners who mutually cooperate and support freedom of navigation and a rules-based order in the Indo-Pacific region.
These are actually illusionary entities. Yes, they have sets of laws and they are separate countries, but the globalists who run the United States and the United Kingdom work together as one entity. So what we have is two countries in which the citizens are taught from young age that they live in a sovereign state. But in fact, the two countries of the UK and the US are both under the basic control of a globalist elite.
The South China Sea is a gateway to major sea routes through which about $3.4 trillion worth of trade passes each year. China claims sovereignty over much of the strategic waterway and has, since 2014, built artificial islands on reefs and installed military bases on them. UK's Defense Secretary has said that London would also eventually deploy a littoral response group to the Pacific. That's a unit of Marines trained to undertake missions including evacuations and anti-terrorism operations.
The UK and the United States function as one entity, especially when they have a common target, which in this time is China and in a secondary level, Iran.
UK's latest policy announcements are in line with the U.S.'s anti-China drive. The Biden administration's approach toward China is taking shape. Many believe Biden will continue the policies of his predecessor to contain China. While the U.S. has seemingly reduced its involvement in West Asia, the American military has sought to refocus its attention on preparing for a conflict with its major rivals, China and Russia, which it considers to be major competition in the insatiable U.S. quest for power and influence. However, Washington's economy and military power is on the wane, and whether Washington likes it or not, it has to change its warmongering policies and adopt a rather more cooperative one, something that is not likely to happen anytime soon.
The United States runs what it is typically called a protection racket. You must pay to buy United States weapons and defense systems in order not to be threatened by the boogeymen that they create out of other independent countries. So the United States is always leaning on its so-called allies because, in effect, with the exception of England, with the exception of the UK, all of the other countries are military protectorates or socio-economic and military colonies of the United States.
How the Biden administration actually deals with thorny issues between the two countries is yet to be seen. It will depend on how China responds to U.S. actions. Given the strong negative public sentiments towards each other and their increasingly divergent domestic political practices, the truly benign strategic competition still remains difficult, if not impossible, to achieve.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
There are a couple of scholars who came with the new ideas, who came with the better principles. And when they came up with those principles and better ideas, how to extract something out of the statement that we have, or what are the principles? Mirza Naini is one of those scholars.
It must be indicated that amongst the publications and works of the late Ayatollah Mirza Manat Hussein Gharavi Naini, his work, Tanbih al-Ummah wa Tanzih al-Millah, is very significant.
Surely we've wronged ourselves, what will we say in front of him?
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the All Beneficent, the All Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher. I'm Atta, the host of this program. I have two guest speakers for my today's discussion in the program. The teacher, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi. Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhrohani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, an Islamic scholar from the Islamic House of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to your show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So in the series of the characters and the dignitaries, we have been concerned, especially the Muslim scholars. Today we want to talk about an outstanding figure of contemporary Iran, Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini, mainly known as Ayatollah Gharavi Naini, who was a Shia jurist and expert in principles of jurisprudence, and also a supporter of the constitutional revolution in Iran, with which we'll be concerned and we'll discuss it more. Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, let's start with you, brother. Muhammad Hussein Naini was among the best explicators of Sheikh al-Ansari's principle of thought and, we can say, method of research regarding Usul al-Fiqh and Fiqh. What more information do we have about the scholarly background and the biography of Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini, mainly known as Ayatollah Gharavi Naini?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Gharavi Naini, or Mirza Naini.
That's right.
Because we have these two famous names about
okay.
him. He was born on 15th of Zilqadda in 1276 Hijri. And he belongs to a scholarly family because his father and his grandfather, both of them, they were Sheikh al-Islam of Isfahan at their time. His father, obviously, Sheikh Abdul Rahim, and his grandfather, Muhammad Said, Sheikh Muhammad Said. They both were from the Sheikh al-Islam of Isfahan, and they were very close to the governments of the time. Now, this is very important, that whenever we see the life of some scholars whose fathers or, you know, grandparents were scholars themselves, obviously it also conveys us another message, that the way he was brought up in his house,
that's right,
that was a house where there was an environment of, you know, scholarly discussions. The family, all the family were educated, the whole family, from, you know, the ladies and the gents, because generally we talk about the males in the family, we
that's
do
right.
not talk about the females, whereas, you know, that the child is with the mother all the time.
That's all right.
Generally, the parents or the fathers are.
That's all right.
Like, they're busy outside,
mm-hmm.
studying, researching,
okay.
I don't know, answering people. So since they were Sheikhul Islam, from Sheikh Naini himself, like Muhammad Hussein, when we talk about him himself,
right.
Mirza Naini, if he was brought up in a such a way, it wasn't only about his father.
Mm-hmm.
It was about his family as well, his
That's
mother
right.
and the environment which was in the family.
Yeah, the
so
mother the mother has really direct role. Although some of the ulama's mothers' names are documented in the history,
yes.
it is claimed that most of the mothers of the family were the memorizers of the whole Quran. They were masters in recitations of the Holy Qurans and Du'as, and they had school-like gatherings in the neighborhood in order to, as we call it, the maktab in Farsi, okay? In
the
order
institute.
To teach the children,
mm-hmm.
The girls and the little girls were taught by the women of the neighborhood, especially the scholarly ones, and the men were by the sheikhs, or
yes,
we can say the ulama
right.
on that time. This was a habit on that time. Unfortunately, we missed this good habit nowadays in neighborhoods in Iran.
So basically, we need to have attention to these things as
yes,
well.
Yes, it is.
It's something
right.
which is ignored, because whenever we come and discuss about an alim, we generally talk about him and his fathers only.
That's all right.
The lineage
yeah.
that he has.
Yeah, the lineage.
We don't talk about the environment that they have in their
Very
family.
Good.
Because, you know, if we're talking about a scholar who became famous, there is a big role of his mother. For example, for Allama Hilli, it is said like his mother used to cook food for him.
That's right.
He never had eaten anything from outside.
Yes.
Even if they used to go somewhere,
okay.
he used to take the food and,
okay.
You know, prepare things.
Being on wuzu when breastfeeding
yes.
the child,
when
you
breastfeeding,
know,
being in
this
the, in
the
state of the wuzu, this
right.
was the habit.
Yes.
So all these things are there.
Important, that's right.
I remember, you know, one of the speeches of Supreme Leader, he said, like, in old age, we had the mothers who had the best character, who raised kids, who became like alim or scholar or mystics.
That's right.
And all the things they were doing was from the Mafatihul Jannah, for example.
Yes.
You know,
okay.
and there were the books, specific books of supplications.
Yes.
They used to read those books,
yes.
and they used to live according to those books. But today,
but it was not only reading, brother. It was
yes.
practicing.
Yeah, that's
the
main
that's
thing.
Important.
Because
that's
you know,
right.
when they're in house, there's an
okay.
environment.
That's
obviously,
right.
when they read, they're practicing those things. And in today's world, also, our you know sisters and mothers should also
yes.
go back to the same original things. You know,
mm-hmm.
these supplication books. They have a lot of things in there, which helps them in training the kids
that's
to
right.
brought up in a good way. So basically, he was brought up in a scholarly family, we can say, and there was a big. Role of his mother and the father, both of them, and the family itself.
That's right.
And he started his early education in Isfahan,
mm-hmm.
In his house, sorry. And later, when he was 17 years old, he went to Isfahan to enter the Hawza.
Okay.
And the good thing about him, which has been said in the history, is that he used to study in the Hawza as well as at the house.
That's all right.
So he also benefeted from his father
That's
and the
right.
things that were in house. I remember, like,
okay.
When I was about to come to the Hawza, my father said, don't buy any book.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have all the books in house.
That's all right.
So if you want to, do not buy, use library whenever you come back to, you know,
okay.
like the country, you can use these books.
Very good.
So there is an environment.
That's right.
And he basically really benefited from
That's
that,
right.
We can say, like, advantages.
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 Yes, of the scholarly family, of, we can say, religious family
yeah.
in which he was born. Dr. Fakhwani, at the age of 17, and after passing the primary studies, he went to Isfahan. He went under the tutelage of Sheikh Muhammad Baqir Isfahani or Jahangir Khan Qashqai. You know, he was a great scholar on that time. Theology, philosophy, jurisprudence, especially philosophy was taught on that time in Isfahan, Hawza too, and Arabic and Persian grammar and mathematics. And then he enters the Hawza of Samarra in Iraq. What information do we have about his studies in Iraq, brother?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bi nasta'in.
Thank you very much for providing me with this opportunity.
You're welcome, brother.
Regarding the late Ayatollah Gharavi Naimi, it must be indicated that at that time a couple of prominent Shia houses were available. I mean, on the eastern side, Lucknow in India was very famous. And then in Persia, Isfahan was very famous because Isfahan at that time was inheriting the legacy of the Safavid dynasty that was in Isfahan. As you know, Isfahan was the capital and the seat of the Safavid administration and government.
That's right.
And many books were authored in Isfahan. For example, the great magnum opus, Bihar al-Anwar, was compiled in Isfahan.
By Allah's Majesty.
If we assume that no other book was compiled in Isfahan save Bihar al-Anwar, this is enough for the whole history of Isfahan and the Hawza of Isfahan.
Okay.
However, the shrine cities in Iraq, Karbala, Najaf, Qazvin, and Samarra, were very famous because of being, historic cities and pilgrimage cities of, the Shi'i denomination. However, we find that at that time, because of strengthening, for the purpose of strengthening the Shi'i community in Samarra, the late Mirza Shirazi, the Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Shirazi, he transferred, his academic seat or community from Najaf to Samarra in order to strengthen the Shi'i community in Samarra. Mm-hmm. So for some time, we find that, Samarra flourished over there.
Okay.
Even
so, beside Najaf and Karbala, Samarra flourished. Samarra's Hausa.
Yes. Yeah. And okay. Even today, the small Shi'i community in Samarra are in fact the traces of that movement of the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Shirazi. But it wasn't only for the sake of academic purposes or for the sake of simply strengthening the Shi'i community in Samarra. Rather, since Samarra was a Sunni populated community in the northern part of the Arabic side of Iraq the Arabic territory of Iraq, and because of this the Othmanids from ancient Turkey, the Othmanids had special influence over there. And since we know that, Iraq has been the arena of two opposing forces, the Shi'i forces from Iran and the Sunni forces from Uthmanis, coupled with the at that time emergent Wahhabi thought, from Arabia. It was the sagacity of the late Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Hassan Shirazi to take his academic seat from Najaf to Samarra.
Right.
First of all, apparently, this was because Samarra was a pilgrimage city over there.
Okay.
But back behind it, there was another philosophy. He meant to strengthen, to reinforce the Shi'i community in an apparently non-Shi'i environment. Okay.
And this was the reason that Ayatollah Gharavi
Naini moved from Isfahan to
Samarra.
And not directly from, to Najaf. Well, on pilgrimage occasions, Ayatollah Gharavi Naini traveled to other pilgrimage cities, but he preferred to remain in Samarra together
with
the late Sayyid Hassan Shirazi.
Okay, and was he contemporary to Akhund al-Khurasani at that time? He was contemporary with Akhund Khurasani.
And to my knowledge, for some time, he studied before Akhund Khurasani, and he explicated some of the views of Akhund Khurasani.
Okay.
But the point is that Akhund Khurasani was a prodigy in Usul al-Fiqh, Ayatollah Gharavi Naini. However, Ayatollah Gharavi Naini almost never attended the open classes of Ayatollah Akhund Khurasani.
Mm-hmm.
However, he attended the special expert community or assembly or expert academy directed by Ayatollah Akhund Khurasani. And it shows that Ayatollah Gharavi Naini was already an authority in Usul al-Fiqh because he almost never attended the open classes of Usul al-Fiqh led and taught by Akhund Khurasani. Rather, he was invited to special gatherings on very delicate issues in Usul al-Fiqh led by Ayatollah Akhund Khurasani.
For issuing fatwa, a council or iftar, isn't it?
Yes, there was a board of, fatwa issuing or issuing fatwas. And even at the moment, even nowadays in Qom, Mashhad, Najaf, Karbala, the great scholars or great mujtahids or maraj taqlid, okay, they have their own special board of, I mean, discussing very delicate issues, okay? And it was to the benefit of not Ayatollah Gharavi Naini, but the existing maraj taqlid in Najaf and Karbala, that's who benefited from the expertise and sagacity of the late Ayatollah Gharavi Naini.
That's all
on
right.
The board of, I mean, issuing fatwas.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhruhani. Also, Said Mohsen Naqvi, for your introductory remarks regarding the late Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Gharavi Naini. We will get into more details of the scholar life of this outstanding Ayatollah, also the role that he had in the socio-political reforms of his time. On that time, he was not a simple Ayatollah and alim scholar, I mean, issuing fatwa and being in the Iftar Council of Akhund Khorasani helped him very much in order to apply some of these fatwas in the daily lives of the people, especially in the socio-political scene of his era and his time, which made him very much different from the other scholars of his time. The late Ayatollah Muhammad Hossein Gharavi Naini. Thank you much, Dr. Fakh.
Welcome.
And Said Mohsen Naqvi. And dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode. In order to know more about our other episodes of the program, The Teacher, refer to our website and visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanillah.
Benjamin Netanyahu has finally been outplayed. His numerous attempts to stay in power, outmaneuver his opponents, and keep his political rivals at bay granted him a reign lasting from 2009 until 2021. But that has come to a swift end. He's been replaced by Naftali Bennett, a man who proudly claims to be even more right-wing than his predecessor and has openly bragged about killing Arabs. So the question now is, what difference does this make for Palestinians? What difference does it make for the region and for those living under Israeli occupation for the better part of almost 80 years? What of their fate?
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Now, before proceeding with the program, it's important to note that Israel is not a legitimate state. It is a racist entity that has been illegally occupying Palestine since 1948 and Syria's Golan Heights since 1967. So when we speak of a so-called Israeli government, we are talking about the administration or the regime that is running the occupation and nothing more. Israel is not recognized as a country by a majority of Arab and Muslim countries and is no more a country than the British occupation in India or the German occupation of Poland or France. Their so-called elections, ministers, and officials have no legitimacy and will only be referred to as such in the program for the sake of simplicity and brevity, nothing more. Now, on June 13, 2021, Benjamin Netanyahu lost his title as the Prime Minister of Israel. In the timeline of events preceding his downfall, many things occurred that led to his ouster. During the last 2 years, from 2019 to 2021, the Israelis had held 4 elections, all of them inconclusive, as no party was actually able to win a majority out of 120 seats. On April 6, 2021, Netanyahu was given 28 days to form a coalition government, but was unable to do so. And consequently, a few weeks after, on May 5th, the president of the Israeli occupation, Rivlin, turned to another Israeli politician named Yair Lapid, who heads the centrist party Yesh Atid. Just a few days after being given this task, Israel launched a new assault on Gaza on May 10th, with massive bombings of public and health infrastructure, slaughtering hundreds of Palestinians and leaving thousands more wounded. Keep in mind that Netanyahu has been troubled by a massive corruption scandal during the last years, a case that remains open and still not reached a conclusion. And it's widely speculated, and perhaps not unreasonably so, that throughout his tenure, Netanyahu has resorted to many tactics, exploiting various crises, such as attacking Gaza, in order to distract from his internal problems and rivalries. Now, his political rivals stopped just short of publicly accusing him of attacking Gaza in May as a ruse to distract from his corruption scandal and troubles of forming a coalition government. And indeed, for a moment, this proved to be fruitful, with multiple outlets reporting that any hopes of a coalition government had been eviscerated.